So we've heard a lot already this morning about the importance of of ecological function, and in a lot of ways, it's something that we don't really know a whole lot about when it comes to insect communities. And I'm going to be talking about this theme and presenting some data that I collected in collaboration with Martin Arford from Saginaw Valley State. So I'm particularly going to focus on land use change, and this is something that I think we all know is really ongoing around the world. We are having conversion of primary habitats like this tropical rainforest into the areas where people live and work, and these are covering just a much larger and larger proportion of the globe. And this land use change is something that's very much ongoing and perhaps even increasing with the advent of things like biofuel cultivation and also pressures from human population growth. And I want to emphasize that it's thought that land use change is actually the primary driver of biodiversity loss worldwide. And bees are a very important taxon, both for ecosystem function in terms of the maintenance of plant reproduction, and also for supporting human communities through agricultural pollination services. There's been a tremendous amount of work on the responses of bee communities to land use change just in the last several years. And I think, you know, even in the late 90s, we didn't have a great idea of what happened when we convert habitats to bees. We've learned really a lot about that, and I think we've done a really good job also of linking land use change to agricultural pollination services. What I think we know a lot less about is how that relates back to ecosystem function in terms of a diverse community of native plants. It's obviously a much more difficult and involved question, but I think it's one that we really need to start focusing on more. And this gets back to the biodiversity and ecosystem functioning debate that Sharon was just talking about. And really a big question here is, how does the diversity and abundance of pollinators affect pollination interactions, again, in these complex communities of native plants? And another really interesting facet of pollination biology that's really just been emerging again in the last few years is work on pollination networks. And it's been found that really around the world and around different kinds of vegetation communities, plant pollinator networks have this kind of asymmetric and nested structure, where most of the interactors are generalists. So most pollinators are visiting a lot of species of plants, and most plants are in turn visited by a lot of species of pollinators. The nested asymmetry comes in if you look at the plant, say, at the very bottom of that diagram. It's visited by one pollinator only, but that pollinator is visiting many, many other species of plants. So even though that plant has one specialist pollinator, that pollinator actually turns out to be a generalist, and the reverse is true. If you look at pollinators that are only visiting one species of plant, that plant is also visited by many species of pollinator. I think building on this, we've had a lot of other realizations about the structure of plant pollinator interactions, and I think it really presents a conundrum in a way, in that how do we actually get successful pollination given that most plants and most pollinators are generalists? And we know that most pollinators are actually opportunistic. They'll happily switch from one plant species to another if they can get a better floral reward out of that next species. And then also given this nested structure of these pollination networks. So it, in a way, if you start thinking about that, it's a kind of amazing that we're able to get successful pollination in native plant communities, yet we know that it happens. So how do we start resolving this conundrum? I think one of the most important aspects is looking at the appropriate temporal scale. So a lot of this work on plant pollinator networks is from these sort of visitation studies where people will sit out in plant communities and record every visitor that comes by a plant or a single flower, and then they'll do that for multiple plant species in that community. But in terms of from the plant's perspective, what they really care about is that the pollinator is transferring the right kind of pollen over the scale of a single foraging trip. And so I think that's a really important scale issue to focus on in this context. So, from the plant's perspective, they want a pollinator to sequentially visit different individuals of the same species and thereby transferring the right type of pollen. And they particularly, a plant particularly wants a pollinator to do that when they have alternate choices that are out there. And this is what's often referred to as floral constancy or floral fidelity. And we have a lot of examples of pollinators doing this in nature. There have been quite a number of studies, especially on bumblebees, but on other pollinators as well, where if you do look within a single trip, they are actually being relatively constant to a single species of plant. The opposite end of the spectrum is this, where a pollinator is sequentially visiting individuals of different species, and that pollinator is in fact doing no good to any of those plants, and in fact doing them some harm by drawing down floral resources that could attract other pollinators, and also by depositing the wrong kind of pollen on the stigmas, and potentially causing some clogging, stigma clogging, or pollen interference. And this is something that we haven't really done a lot of work on from a landscape scale. This is a quote by Stefan de Winter et al. In Nick Wasser and Jeff Ullerton's recent book, that we just really haven't thought about these kind of foraging interactions at a landscape scale. And I'd take this even a little bit further to say that we haven't really thought about the local biotic context. So the diversity of pollinators, the diversity of plant species that are out there. This is something that I've been studying from the context of looking at the pollen loads carried by individual pollinators. And these actually present a very good record of all of the plant species that a pollinator has visited over the course, again, of that single foraging trip. I'm doing this by examining those pollen loads from bees that I've caught along two landscape gradients in southern Costa Rica, and looking, I'm going to present today only on samples that I've taken from deforested habitats, these rustic pasture samples, and pollen that I removed from Trigona corvina, a meliponine or social stingless bee. And here's a picture of that Trigona foraging in one of our rustic pasture areas on a rubus, which we know is visited by lots and lots of different pollinator species. And in fact, Sharon had several pictures of different pollinators on rubus as well. So the data come from the landscape in and around the Las Cruces Biological Station in southern Costa Rica, which is at about 1,100 meters above sea level, and it's sort of pre-montane tropical rainforest in the areas that have not yet been cleared. And here's a map of my study area. The green on the map here are remnant patches of forest, and I have two gradients, one of distance to forest, and then a separate gradient along a gradient of forest fragment size. And there are about 40 sites here in total. And the data I'm going to present today, we've done a bunch of different sampling methods for bees, but these come only from netting samples from these pastures. And from this work, we've collected more than 4,000 specimens of bees that represent about 180 species. And so it's really one of the largest systematically collected data sets on tropical bees that's out there. And I've been doing this since 2003. And really the central question that I've been talking about is how do both landscape context and also that local biotic context, the diversity of plants and pollinators, how do those affect pollinator floral fidelity over the course of a single foraging trip? And I think it's really important to think about potential mechanisms that might be going on here in terms of how that might actually happen. Like I mentioned before, we know that pollinators in many contexts really are opportunistic. Greater competition should lead to finer resource partitioning, if you think about competition theory and optimal foraging theory, and hence to greater floral fidelity. Meliponine bees in particular also have a couple of specific behaviors. There's a lot of interference competition. Some species of meliponines will kick other pollinator species off of off of flowers can be very aggressive, and they also lay down scent trails. There's a really interesting talk about that on Monday. And so they have some specific mechanisms that might allow them to focus on particular plant species. And so in thinking about these mechanisms, it really appears that the biotic context, or the diversity and abundance of the plants and pollinators, is probably much more important than this larger scale landscape context, or so I hypothesize. And in terms of thinking about predictions from this, I've thought that with increasing bee abundance, you know, going back to those mechanisms, we have greater competition, greater partitioning of the floral resource. So we have a reduction in pollinator infidelity, as I've shown here, which could be thought of as increasing fidelity. And the same thing is true of bee diversity there. I also think that the taxon identity is actually important. This is something that Sharon also was talking about a little bit. And I hypothesize that there should be stronger patterns for meliponines relative to other bees in the bee community, given these olfactory references that they put down, as well as the interference competition that they're known to engage in. So when we start thinking about the plant community, however, I think we should actually see the opposite pattern. So with more flowers that are out there and more types of flowers, that should actually reduce the competition in the community. And I think we should see an increase in floral infidelity, or that is a decrease in floral constancy, with increasing density of flowers and also the increasing species richness of flowers. Whereas, as I mentioned before, I think the biotic context is going to be a lot more important, and I think we shouldn't see much of a response when it comes to landscape context, because these interactions are really occurring over a much smaller spatial scale. So again, we remove the pollen loads from these trigona bees, and did this using the fuchsin jelly method. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but you basically make this little cubes of jello and dab them over the bee's body. This is very painstaking and detail-oriented work. So I have a couple of heroic undergraduates who've been helping me with this, it's taken quite a long time to actually do this the right way, and we've tried to be really thorough. One thing that we have done that I think is really important is separated out the body pollen from the pollen that's carried in the corbicular loads on the pollen baskets on the bee's leg. And you know, sometimes they will collect different species of pollen and focus on that, and you know, but still be visiting other species of flowers. So I'm really glad that we separated out those two different kinds of pollen loads. We melted the fuchsin jelly on slides, and we sent it off to Michigan, where my collaborator Martin Arford identifies all the pollen. And he's just amazing in terms of being able to separate out all these species from a very diverse plant community. And because I don't have to sit in a darkened bunker in Saginaw identifying pollen, this is pretty much what I think about Marty. So he's just a fantastic collaborator. So I'll get right into some of the results. First of all, if we look at just the total number of pollen species we see per bee, we actually have most bees carrying many different species of pollen. However, there are a lot of possibilities for contamination, and you know, they may land on a flower that another bee had visited that wasn't being constant and pick up the wrong kind of pollen, and you can think of any number of other ways. So we really are focused on the sort of main species of pollen that these bees are carrying, so that comprise at least 5% of the pollen load. And it's actually really easy to separate those out. Species of pollen that I think are there from contamination really occur in very low densities in these pollen loads. So about 30% of the bee specimens in this work are being constant to one species of plant. So again, I predicted that we'd see a decrease in pollinator infidelity, or that is an increase in fidelity with greater bee abundance or diversity. And that is actually indeed what we find when we look at this. These are the results for bee abundance. These are results from logistic regressions. And we also see the same pattern a little less strong, but for bee species richness. So does taxon matter? That was something I asked earlier. And the same trends definitely apply when you're considering only the meliponine bees, a strong response from richness and a significant response from meliponine abundance as well. What I think is really interesting is then when you look at the bee community other than meliponine, so the non-meliponine bees, bee abundance is still significant, but bee species richness is no longer so. So taxon really does appear to matter, and the meliponines appear to be a really driving force here. So I thought we'd see the opposite trend when it came to plants. So with increasing plant diversity or density, we'd see an increase in pollinator infidelity. Again, this actually appears to be borne out by our analyses where we have a significant response of plant density. And we also, and I actually think this is something that we could, that could be even stronger when we start looking at species-specific resources that they are providing to pollinators, the amount of nectar and the nutritional quality of pollen, et cetera. And we also saw the same trend even stronger for plant species richness. So does the landscape matter? This is something I thought we might be seeing a much weaker response from, and actually this is that flat line prediction. And indeed, when we look at the proportion of forest surrounding our sample sites at a 400 meter radius, we don't see any response at all in terms of the floral fidelity of the meliponines. This 400 meter radius is from several different samples, what we found the landscape scale that meliponines are responding most strongly to forest. And this is the same if you look at only the subset of sites that are collected along those that gradient of forest fragment size. We see no landscape response whatsoever. So in conclusion, both the pollinator and the plant community context, so diversity and abundance, really are affecting floral fidelity, and actually in the same direction that we predicted. And landscape context per se does not appear to be having any effect on floral fidelity, but the taxon identity matters, and that meliponines are very important here. And I want to stress that meliponines, we do find them foraging out in these deforested areas, but they're one of the, they have some of the strongest responses to the landscape in terms of reductions in diversity and abundance when you get out further away from forest, and also in smaller forest fragments. So we do see a landscape response, but it's one that's really mediated by the diversity and abundance of the pollinators. So I'm building on this work to in a couple of ways to really explore this topic more. So first of all, I'm going to be doing some work looking at the pollen loads on floral stigmas, not on pollinators. So getting a better idea of the transferring of pollen between different individuals of plants, and also between plant species. I'm going to be doing some modeling work combining optimal foraging theory and some competition work with previous work that's been done on floral constancy, because there are also some insect cognition and memory components to this question as well. And then finally, I'm proposing to do some experiments in simplified systems where you can control the diversity and abundance of both plants and pollinators. And with that, I'd like to acknowledge all of the people that made this work possible, and I'd be happy to take questions if I have time. Yeah, Rufus?
You mentioned separating out the corbicular loads from the surface pollen on the bees. Could you analyze that separately to see if you get different results?
We actually haven't yet analyzed that separately. One thing I neglected to mention in the talk is that these only represent about half of the specimens that we've removed pollen from. It does take Marty quite a while to identify the pollen, so there's still somewhat preliminary results. But no, we haven't yet looked. It does appear, just from glancing at the data, that we are picking up different species on the body pollen than the corbicular loads. I mean, I know from the identities that, at least in some cases, there is a difference, but I haven't looked at it statistically. Yeah. Yeah, back there.
Yeah, I just wonder in your taxon specificity as you're calling it, whether you should not be saying in your social organization specificity, because among the ape parts are melatonin, for example, we have, we're talking about the social apes.
Right.
But among that same group are a great number of solitary apes. And solitary apes, I don't believe, have the same behavior pattern as you see here.
I think all melponines in this area are eusocial.
Well, yes. You're talking about a taxon. What is your reference to taxon? Is it a tribe? Is it a genus?
I see.
A species? Or is it a subfamily?
Right.
And I think you don't distinguish there, and I think this is misleading.
No, I completely agree, and that's actually something that we've been thinking a lot about, because you know, even when you start partitioning the group of meliponines even a little further, I think there are species that are engage in a lot of interference competition, for example, and those species might be much more important when it comes to mediating this change in floral fidelity. So it is something that we're definitely going to look at in much finer detail. And I think you're right that thinking about social organization as well is something that could be really interesting. Yeah.
Have you thought of looking at different areas of the bee's body as to where the pollen is being placed? Does that actually have a major effect that, you know, they can be in constant and yet still be constant from the plant's perspective?
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, there's been some really good work on different placement of pollen, and in particular with euglossian bees and orchids, you know, with pollinaria placed in different parts of the bee's body. When we first started doing this work, we tried to separate it out and put the different body parts on different slides. And this work is just so fine scale and so exhausting that it was just taking way too long to do that. And I agree, in an ideal world, we'd be able to do that, but it just practically does not work. I think one thing that we'll start to maybe get at that is this work that I'm proposing by looking at floral stigmas. So that will actually tell us much more about the pollen that's being transferred from one species to another, and that's something we've definitely thought about. All right, thank you.